Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The Delta variant now makes up more than 80% of new COVID cases in the country, and the uptick is seen everywhere. In Sacramento County, vaccination numbers are still relatively low when compared to the statewide average. In California, roughly 61% of residents are fully vaccinated. Countywide, the fully vaccinated rate is just under 50%, and some neighborhood pockets in the county are hovering around 35%. We're going to dive into those numbers and learn more about the why, as well as what's being done as cases rise. Dr. Olivia Casirier is Sacramento County's public health officer. She joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you.
Dr. Casirier, you are now probably 16, 17 months into this. I have interviewed you many times as you've been thrust as a public health officer into this spotlight. How are you doing?
Well, it's been quite a journey with ups and downs. And until a few weeks ago, we were doing well. The numbers were going in the right direction and we were out with the vaccination. But unfortunately, in the past few weeks, we've had an unfortunate turn and the numbers are going up. We're getting about 200 cases a day. Our case rate has risen to 14.7 per 100,000. And of course, this is due to the more contagious Delta variant.
You know, when looking at the numbers and understanding the what, I mean, that's important. What is the why behind these numbers and these rising cases?
It's two factors. One, the Delta variant is a lot more contagious. And the other is that, as you've mentioned, with our vaccination rates, we're still not where we want to be. We would ideally want to be at 70% vaccination, but we still have a long way to go. If you look by zip code, some of the zip codes are doing really well, but then we have those areas, especially in the underserved communities, where the vaccination rates are low. And when you look at the cases we're getting, the majority of the cases are people that are not vaccinated. So the virus is finding ways into the community, especially for those that are still vulnerable and causing disease.
We're now at a point where vaccinations are widely available. Going back to spring, when that wasn't the case, did you envision being in this position now at the end of July?
We were hoping that we would be further along. We've worked really hard. But we also do recognize that a lot of people do have barriers and we need to address those barriers. In addition, we also have to address the misinformation, especially that is circulating in social media. And we know that a lot of people are more dependent on their social circles for information. And so they are watching what they're seeing on social media and thinking that that is what they, you know, the information is correct. So we need to be able to dispel that. And it's a lot of work. It's hard work. Sometimes it's going one person at a time in order to talk to them and convince them that they need to get vaccinated.
I think pretty much anyone could relate to what you just said, whether it's a family member or a friend. Have you personally had those conversations with your loved ones and friends as well?
Absolutely. Yes, I have. Many of them have been able to convince and answer their questions. For others, it's more a matter of them thinking that they're not at risk. So continuing to give them information about what we're seeing and how serious it is, and continuing to encourage them to get vaccinated.
That must be so frustrating, given that you're a public health officer and a doctor.
It is, but I think we all recognize that people are at different places. And as I mentioned, they are dependent on their social circles. And it's up to us to continue with the message, the correct message, until we convince them to get vaccinated.
You know, going beyond Sacramento County, because we're not all just confined within county limits. I mean, we're really regional. You have Yolo, Placer, El Dorado, San Joaquin counties, and the vaccination rate hovers between the low 40 to low 50 percentile for those who are fully vaccinated. You know, with that hindsight and that perspective, what are the unique challenges in our area?
So what we've found is that there are multiple factors. I've talked about the vaccine hesitancy, but there are also a lot of people that have barriers. There are a lot of people who will not leave their area to go out to get services. And there are a lot of people who will not receive services from people that they're not accustomed to getting services from. And that's why what we've found that is so important is using what we call trusted messengers, working with community-based agencies and working with people from those communities to bring the message and also to assist us with the vaccinations. For some of the community-based agencies we are working with, they've actually been going door to door to call people out and say, hey, we have a clinic here, you need to come and get vaccinated.
When working with those community partners, especially the ones that are going door to door and talking to people individually, is there any stories that kind of stand out to you and help shape your decisions and how you kind of think about new solutions to kind of combat the stalled case rate here or vaccination rate here?
I think what has come across is, again, that we need to keep going, that even just being able to convince one person is important, because the next time you go around, you'll get additional people that will be interested. Because sometimes we find people who will say, well, I'll wait until my friends get vaccinated and then I'll do it too. So we need to keep going back. We can't give up because we know that the vaccine is our way out of this. We know the vaccine is effective, and so it is our duty to continue with the message, to continue providing the vaccine to those that are still vulnerable. And just to give you a very quick story, one time when we went out to the homeless, one gentleman who received the vaccine said that he had seen us giving vaccinations at another clinic, but he didn't feel comfortable coming forward. So he was very appreciative that we had come out to him. So that's important, that we need to go out to where the people are and be able to remove barriers so that people can get vaccinated.
Right, because one person can have ripple effects for their
exactly.
surrounding friends and loved ones.
Exactly. That gentleman, the next time we went to give him his second dose, he had his wife and his mother there. So that's a success.
Yeah, I followed Yolo County for a similar kind of mission, you know, just walking the streets and meeting people where they are to vaccinate them. That's also a huge undertaking when it comes to staffing. I mean, when it comes to staffing and funding, going from person to person, do you just feel that the cards are stacked against you sometimes?
We recognize that it is hard, but we also recognize what we're up against and we have to do it. We are very appreciative for all of the assistance we're getting from the state, from the community-based agencies, and a lot of volunteers. So many people have come forward and are doing this not because they're getting paid, but because they see the importance of it. So that keeps us going.
You know, masks, they're currently recommended indoors in Sacramento County, but they're not mandatory. Is there a concern if cases continue to rise and the vaccination rate continues to kind of stall that if it does become mandatory, there'll be a backlash?
Well, those are things that we have to consider, but I think the most important thing is to do the right thing. And right now, we do still have the mandate at the state level that requires that anybody who is not vaccinated has to wear a mask indoors. And so our strong recommendation was, of course, as we were seeing the numbers rising and recognizing that even for people that are vaccinated, just because of the level of virus that is circulating, that their risk is increased as well. So making sure that, we put the message out, especially also for people that may have underlying conditions, that they can take this additional layer of protection. And so we continue to monitor and we continue to talk with the state to see if there are additional steps that need to be taken. But one important thing, again, to point out is that we do have three vaccines that we know are very effective. That's the main thing that we're pushing right now, and we're going to continue moving with it.
You know, kind of on the flip side, there's a growing sentiment among, you know, some people who are vaccinated and, you know, they believe that they did their duty. They got vaccinated. They participated in the greater good for the protection of themselves and for others. And maybe there's a growing kind of resentment or frustration with those who are still hesitant or on the fence. Are you hearing this as well within our community? And where do you see this going?
We do hear it from time to time, but it's important for us to realize that for some of these situations where it's impacting the entire community, we have to move together. Oftentimes we've talked about what we call community immunity or herd immunity, because every single one of us has a role to play, and together we are able to protect one another. So, we just continue to encourage them, thank them that they did the right thing, but also continue to ask them actually to work with us, to talk to people that they know in their circle that they can encourage to get vaccinated, because they might have the biggest influence on the people that are related to them or their friends.
Well, on the topic of herd immunity, has that phrase kind of been deflated in the context of this and with the Delta variant and with the current vaccination rate?
Actually, we are seeing why it is so important. Because, for example, when we look at the long-term care facilities, in previous surges, we got a lot of outbreaks and many people ending up in the hospital that were from these long-term care facilities and nursing homes. But right at the beginning of the vaccination effort, the pharmacies were out there vaccinating, and we have 90 to 100% vaccination in the long-term care facilities, and that has protected them. Because right now we're getting only a few cases, and most times these are people who are employees that are not vaccinated. But the majority of the long-term care facilities, we're not getting cases. And that proves that, one, these vaccines are effective, and also is a demonstration of the herd immunity. But it's important for us to look at the rest of the community as well. As you pointed out, we still have some areas with low vaccination rates, and those are the areas that are most vulnerable.
The state health department is saying all kids, regardless of their vaccination status, will need to wear masks when school goes back into session in just a few weeks. And obviously, we've got a lot of families here. What do parents and students need to know?
You know, it's important for them to recognize that right from the start, we took steps to protect the children. Schools were the first sector to close. And even when we started having children back in school, we had a lot of protocols in place with social distancing, with options for virtual learning, and also with masking. So with this new year coming up, this is the first time that we're having all of our children back in person. And many of them are not even eligible for vaccination. So masking basically is the only layer of protection that we have for these children. And it's important for us to be able to provide that for our children. We hope that it will just be for a short period of time until we get through this surge, and also until we're able to provide a vaccine for even the younger children below 12. But until then, we really need to do everything we can. And this is one thing that's very simple. Children we know have been doing it. They're able to tolerate the masks very well. And we're only requiring them to do this indoors. I think for parents to recognize how important it is and to continue protecting the children.
You know, one of my final questions, you know, just thinking about, you know, the year and a half that you've endured as a public health official, and it is your job. It could be an unpopular one, especially in a year unlike any other. What do you still love about being a public health official?
I love working with my staff. We have a very dedicated, very skilled group, a team that has been working. We've been working side by side from the beginning, long hours, 7 days a week, and they see the importance of this. They're not giving up. They're continuing to get out there, get people vaccinated. The other is also the community. We have had so many partnerships that have been formed even during this time, and just being able to see people being able to help people. We've had people who've come for the vaccination, especially at the beginning, where they just broke down in tears because they were now had the protection and they were able to know that they were safe and that they could be able to meet with their grandchildren again. So just seeing that and knowing that we have a part to play, I think is important. And at this time with a pandemic that's, you know, the biggest we've seen since 1918, I think it's a call of duty for us to make sure that we do everything we can to save lives.
It's definitely an invaluable silver lining to all of this. Last question, because, you know, I've talked to you a lot, and this is not going to be the last conversation. In the latest chapter we're in the saga of COVID, what keeps you up at night?
Right now, it's the numbers that I'm seeing. With the case rate going up 1 point every single day, and worrying that, hoping that at least for the long-term care facilities, that the protection will continue to hold. And also knowing that we have a vaccine that's available and just trying to get it out there. So looking for ways, thinking of what else can we do to get the message out. What else can we do to convince people that this is something we need to do right now?
Dr. Olivia Kisirye is Sacramento County's public health officer. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicki.
Up next, the day meant for last year is finally here, the 2020 Tokyo Olympics. We have the perfect guest to warm us up for an Olympic Games unlike any other, with the past 10 Olympics under their belt. You can join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org, or use the Twitter hashtag #AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Inside here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The threat of COVID-19 is looming large over the Tokyo Summer Olympics, where the competition kicked off on Wednesday before the opening ceremony tomorrow. There's rigorous testing and the safety protocols for not only Olympic athletes and their teams, but really anyone connected with the Games. And Tokyo Olympics CEO Toshiro Muto would not rule out pulling the plug on the Games as the number of positive COVID cases continues to climb across the Japanese capital. New daily infections in Tokyo spiked to a six-month high, and all fans are banned from Olympic venues. There aren't as many journalists over in Tokyo right now, and those staying back really had to just reimagine how to cover the Games and its world-class athletes, including KCRA anchor Deirdre Fitzpatrick and photojournalist Mike Domolog. I know them kind of well. I spent the past 5 years at KCRA before moving over to Insight. Fitz and Dami, as they are affectionately called in the newsroom, have traveled around the globe for the Olympics and have covered the last 10 games together. That's 20 years. But this year is a first. They're going to be like us mere mortals and watching it, the Tokyo Olympics from home. So with that said, let's bring in KCRA's Deirdre Fitzpatrick and Mike Domolog. Welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having us, Vicki. Appreciate it.
Hi. Do you hear me? I hope you hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you, Dami. I can see you too. I can see you're in the newsroom parking lot. I guess for the both, just first off, what really just kind of crossed my mind is how weird is it for the both of you to be in Sacramento right now?
You know what's really weird is I have that same feeling that I have the day before the opening ceremony, maybe Dami does too, where, you know, we usually go over to an Olympics about a week before and you do all the pre-work of getting a lot of stories done. There's just a lot of work. You have to set up a mobile newsroom. There's, a time change to get used to. There's just a lot of work. And you finally get to the opening ceremony and you feel like, oh my gosh, it hasn't even started yet. And you're so exhausted. And I woke up this morning, and maybe you did too, Dami. I'm exhausted and it hasn't even started yet. And I'm here.
Well, I'm actually feeling kind of refreshed. I just finished my 21-day, three and a half mile walk. I feel good. And I know I have a few things ahead of me to edit. So I actually feel pretty good.
Okay, well, good for you. Good for Dami.
So let's logistically get out of the way. The role of the Olympic team for not only KCRA, but Hearst Television, which owns KCRA and other stations across the country, because it's really been the two of you for the past 20 years.
Yeah, so the way this has always worked for us is not what most of our local viewers probably expect, but Hearst Television owns nearly 30 stations across the country, Sacramento and KCRA being one of them. So what we've done is we've had a team of anywhere from 8 to 9 people who have gone to the Olympics and done group coverage and gathered content for all of those stations. And so on a day-to-day basis, yes, you'll see us on KCRA, but you also would have seen me on 29 other stations across the country. So we would be from our Olympic Live location, standing in front of a camera for 6.5 straight hours, doing Olympic stories over and over again, every couple of minutes, switching to a new city, a new station, a new set of anchors. So there's actually been a lot that happens behind the scenes that our local viewers don't see, but it's been, a really amazing opportunity over the years. And we have gotten to, as you said earlier, we've gotten to travel to places that I probably never would have gone to before, that I may never go to again, working on this project. And we've had this front row seat to what I think we both think is the greatest show on earth.
Yeah, and we started like a years before gathering and pulling file and doing things. Then we jump on this flight that takes 1,000,000 hours, and then we jump right off the flight, get to our equipment, and then shoot a promo. And we really look, I look terrible, but she looks great. And then we do those promos, and then we just hit it and we go and we run. So
yeah, it's a run and gun kind of, as we call it, kind of assignment. It's 3.5 straight weeks every single day. There are no days off, and you work 20, 21 hours a day straight. And people who go on their first trip with us, they never believe it when we say that it's going to be like that. They never do. And then they get there and they're like, what have I signed up for? But that's, we're not unique in that. Everybody who's there is doing it because it's the only thing that they're there for. And only a limited number of people can go. So it just kind of has to get done. And when you're in that environment, it's so much fun. It is so much fun. The challenge, of course, this one being that, there's just a real new narrative for this Olympics that's never been there before. It's so unique. And, for the people who are over there right now, the challenges that they're facing aren't just getting the job done, but also staying healthy.
Right. When talking with your colleagues who are actually, and the friends you've made over the years who are currently in Tokyo covering the Olympics, what are they telling you?
So I've heard very consistent stories from all of them that it's super, super serious. Like everybody is following the rules. And because the problem is if you don't follow a rule, if you don't do what you've been told to do, you will be told you're leaving. And nobody wants to call the boss and say, oh, yeah, I crossed the line to go get a shot. Nobody wants to be that person right now. What I have heard is that this testing process to get into the country is legit hard. I have a good friend, Cassidy, who is over there right now working for the Olympic Broadcasting System. She had to take 3 COVID tests 72 hours before she left Portland. She gets to Tokyo. One of those 3 results did not make it into the system. She was stranded in the airport for almost 36 hours because they wouldn't let her go through until they got the result of that test. When she finally got the result of that test, she had to go through another test at the airport before she then was allowed to move on to her accommodations. So, they have 3 solid days of kind of a quarantine, a soft quarantine where they're only allowed in certain areas. And then it opens up a little bit to go to other areas. But this is not going to be your typical you know, seeing the sights kind of Olympics, where you're going out and you're touring and trying the food with the locals and seeing all the cool, like, travel, you know, tourist traps and stuff. There's not going to be any of that. You're going to be very limited in your movement, which has happened at other games for other reasons. But this one is definitely just such a different environment to work in.
I'll tell you, remember I almost got sent home. It's no fun hiding under the table for 48 hours.
True story.
All right, happen. You got to give the backstory. When did you almost get sent home, Donnie?
Well, Athens, we just kind of followed an athlete clean into the Olympic village.
Hold on. I had nothing to do with, there's no we. I am not part of this we. This is one of the few times Donnie was not working with me. Because I would not have let this happen. Go ahead, Donnie. You tell her what you did.
We followed an athlete. And toured the athletes' village where we weren't supposed to go. We skirted everybody, flew by everything, and wound up at the track meet at the track and in front of guns. So they escorted us out. Then we got in trouble by network, by our company, and I hid for 24 hours or so under a table. Just kind of crossed my fingers they wouldn't send me home, and they didn't send me home, and I didn't work with that person again for the rest of the trip.
And this is why you do not leave my side.
No. So getting kicked out is no fun.
You know, I guess with that said, you know, I mean, you're talking about working, you know, 20 to 21 hours a day. You have time change. You're doing live shots, mind you, for United States stations. When and where do you sleep? That is a big question that I've been getting.
Did you sleep much? I didn't.
You don't. You don't sleep very much. I will tell you, Dami can sleep anywhere. It's a gift. And there will be times where I'll look at him and I can just see how tired he is. And I'll say, look, I'm writing this story. You've got 45 minutes. Why don't you go to the back corner? And you'll see other people do the same thing where they'll just lay down and go to sleep. I mean, people fall asleep in very strange places at the Olympics because they are so tired. my superpower is that I can power through without having a lot of sleep. And the one thing about being on the Olympic project when you're overseas is you have no other responsibilities. When I'm home, I have kids, I have animals, I have bills to pay. I've got, you know, dishes that are in the sink that are driving me crazy. You have no other distractions when you're overseas working on a project like that. So, you know, you can kind of jump in and go, look, it's 21 straight days of work and I'm going to enjoy every minute of it. And a lot of it is attitude and being with the right person. I can honestly say, I don't think I could have done 10 straight of these if it wasn't with Mike Domolog, because the partnership is so legit unique. And like no other work partnership I have ever had, he completes me. No, he is just such a great personality to be with. And he geeks out on this stuff as much as I do. And it never gets old with him. And it doesn't with me either. So we are constantly like looking around and taking a moment sometimes to say, oh, look at that. Look where we are. Let's go eat that. We look for those moments to really enjoy them.
And that's where you come in, because you could turn a cookie into a 5-minute package. It was so much fun working with you, because we could just, I draft off you loads of maybe 65 pounds. Winter Olympics, a lot more weight, extra clothes, and summer it's a little less, it's like 5 pounds less, but I draft off you all the time, and you kind of carry my load with your spirit. It's a lot of fun, because I know I could go out with one idea and come back with four different stories.
I think it's so important to also just kind of brush people up on like really your tenure, both of yours at KCRA. You know, Dami, you've spent 36 years at KCRA. Deirdre, you started in 1997, and so you've been covering the Olympics since 2000. Did either of you envision having this perk to your job as a journalist? Or is it even, it is a perk, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Dami, why don't you answer first?
I always wanted to travel. KCRA traveled when I first got here. I didn't realize Olympics was part of it. I mean, 92, I was supposed to go to Barcelona, but because of the economics, a week before I was supposed to go to Barcelona, my ticket was ripped from my hand. So I have this motto, never count on going anywhere till you're on the plane. So I kind of live by that now. And so, you know, this is a disappointment, but you know what? I still get to cover it from here, and it's still fun.
And no, I never would have thought that I would have an opportunity to do this to the level that I have. But I will tell you that I was very close to leaving KCRA after like 2 years of being there. I was just ready. I was very young. I was ready to move on and do other things. And we had a head of the company who had been trying to talk me into going to the morning show. And I wanted nothing to do with the morning show, like nothing. And he kept asking me like, why are you so opposed to the morning show? And I said, because I want to do big things in my career. And I didn't see the morning show as a way to do big things. And he said, I think you're wrong. I think the morning show is going to be the future of what we do in local television. And I can promise you, you will do big things. And at the time, I had just been assigned to go to the Sydney Olympics. And I said, yes. And so that's how I ended up on the morning show. And the big things that came along were getting to work on this corporate project every 2 years. And we're always shocked when we're asked to work on it. It's not a given. It's not an assumption that we go to every Olympics. It really isn't. And neither one of us has ever actually asked to go on this trip. And we know that it's a big deal to go, but it is incredibly gratifying to get rewarded for hard work by getting to go on this project. But it is a lot of work, and it starts, the actual hands-on putting the stories together starts a minimum of 6 months before the games. But you really kind of live it year-round because you're always tracking people and watching for people and looking for opportunities to meet up with them. So if you didn't love it, it would not be a fun job at all. But we both love the Olympics and what they represent so much that getting to tell these stories to not only our KCRA viewers, but our viewers across Hearst Television is just a joy.
And we have quite the Olympic community here in the greater Sacramento area. And it's just so cool that, you know, I mean, Dami, you're basically like you're an archival, you're a human archive. And the fact that you really can follow athletes when maybe they're in high school or, you know, they're 18, 19 and follow them and the trajectory of their career. And you have that video is just so valuable.
Well, it just takes like a weekend or a couple of days where there's somebody down south I really need to get some video of. I don't know why. And they cut me loose. I go do it. And I just kind of store it away. And boom, 4 years later, that person is doing something. And heck, yesterday we did a story and this kid's going to go somewhere in the next 4 years. And I know he's down in Los Banos. So, heck, I'm going to put that away or squirrel it away and somebody will have it for next time.
I want to get to some fun stuff that people don't really know about. How do you guys have fun, you know, working 21-hour days? I mean, Dami, I know you're a big golfer. Deirdre, you have ran countless marathons, ultra marathons, Ironmans. You know, you're a superwoman. Do you still fit in that stuff?
I do, not to that level, obviously. But you have your own routine when you're on the road doing something like this. And my routine is I get up and I work out. Like, it might not be a long time, but I need the routine of having something that's away from the Olympics. So I'll find whatever gym they have and go do like, you know, 30 minutes. But then you're also moving all the time. And you're, you know, we walk like 10 miles a day covering the Olympics and doing things. So you're kind of active the entire time.
Oh, and just meeting the people out there, because we have a free pass to get into everything. So we'll meet people like in Russia, went to curling and we ran into a Russian family. That's a lot of fun. And, you know, you got to have the occasional red wine at the end of the night. And I'll bring a breakdown putter and I'll putt every now and then down a hallway. and, you know, I'll bring darts, just goof around a little bit.
He really does. But, you know, fun is a choice. You go into each day deciding, am I going to make the best of this? Am I going to find some fun? And no matter where you are, you can find something that is so ludicrous that you can share a laugh over it, or, you know, you have something to look forward to throughout the day. But, you know, we just kind of really, we are very conscious of trying to be in the moment, because it's very easy to let go of the moments when you get tired and to like lose the thrill of the experience of being there. And once you do, it gets reflected in your story. So we are constantly looking for like those moments where you just can't even believe something is happening, you know, and looking for ways to like have a really good time no matter what. I mean, I remember we were in Beijing in 2008 and we were trying to get to Tiananmen Square to meet up with a local high school marching band that was performing. I mean, like super random. And we had no way to really communicate with the taxi driver. Somebody had written down in Chinese where we were going, but the taxi driver had just had it with us because for whatever reason, he couldn't get there because of road closures or something. And he ordered us to get out of the car. And I refused to get out of the taxi because I didn't know where I was. And Donnie finally was like, we got to get out of this car. He's really angry. And I just kept like refusing to get out of the taxi. And what Donnie didn't know was I was pregnant at the time. So I had hormones, you know, also kind of raging while this was going on. And so finally, like the taxi driver, like physically made me get out of the car. And we just started walking through Beijing looking for Tiananmen Square. And so I finally wrote it on a piece of paper and I held it up walking down these streets in Beijing trying to find Tiananmen Square till I found somebody who could read English. Mm. And that was how we finally got to Tiananmen Square with like 2 minutes to spare to get video of this marching band. But it's those kinds of stories that I look back at years later and I laugh till I cry because I mean, who has those moments? We have, and many of them.
Oh, just driving back with the crew and catching the bus and then coming up with that idea, the bus ride home, and we would do a live podcast or live cast and all the things. I keep forgetting, can't cuss on the radio, can't cuss and this and that. And I point out things out the window and, oh, I can't say hooker.
Yeah, I definitely understand, you know, with the work pace and y'all going through, you know, getting that frustration and maybe wanting to throw a profane word here and there. But I guess just kind of wrapping up, given that it is a 21-day challenge that I just learned about listening to your podcast, Deirdre, Dying to Ask, in addition to being an anchor at KCRA in the mornings, just get us up to speed on the 21-day challenge and kind of, you know, just adjusting to this kind of new way of covering the Olympics this time
around.
Sure.
So the 21-day challenge is something that we've kind of talked about would be a great idea for years. And so 2008 Olympic gold medalist Gabe Gardner, who lives in Sacramento, he and I have talked about it for years. Like, we should do this challenge during the Olympics where people get off the couch and they actually get out and focus on their health while being inspired by the Olympics. And honestly, being overseas, I've never had time to really do that in addition to everything else. So when we found out in March that we were going to be here, I called Gabe and I said, you know, I'm here and I am really disappointed that I don't get to go be a part of the Olympics this year in person. I need a project. What would you think of us coming up with this challenge? So we started chatting about it. We came up with this idea of 21 days because that's kind of the minimum amount of time to start a habit. And my thought has been, and Gabe's, is that, you know, we're coming out of the pandemic. Our physical, our mental health have really taken hits. So let's be inspired by these Olympians who have spent a lifetime for sometimes moments of opportunity to compete on an international stage. And let's commit to focusing on our health and being inspired for 15 minutes a day to do something. So exercise, it could be meditation, it could be taking the dog for a walk, just 15 minutes a day, but for 21 straight days, let's do that. So every day we have a story that will air in our Olympic Zone show that will teach you a health hack. And most of them are being delivered by Olympians who, years after they've competed, are really honest about saying that they too struggle for motivation, which is the most satisfying feeling ever to find out it's not just all of us, but it's everybody. And so our hope is that at the end of the 21 days, you feel inspired to go off into the year, hopefully with better conditions for all of us pandemic-wise, but feeling like you can take some control of your health.
KCRA anchor Deirdre Fitzpatrick and Mike Domalog, who've been covering the Olympics as the Olympic team for Hearst Television for the past 20 years. That is 10 Olympics. I already know you're eyeing Winter Olympics in 2022 and already probably gathering footage. Great chatting with both of you and nice to see you.
Oh, it's nice to see you too. And we miss you around the newsroom, but I love what you're doing here on this show.
Thank you.
All right, Vicky.
Bye, Dommy. All right, still ahead, Cap Radio's summer concert series is coming to a close, but you don't have to worry. Cap Radio's own Jennifer Reason joins us with a wrap-up and how to catch the live performances you may have missed. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Inside on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. CAP Radio's summer concert series is coming to a close, but don't worry, you can still enjoy the live music online with videos. CAP Radio brought six ensembles to our garden to play live music, which was recorded and produced into hour-long specials that were played every Friday at noon. CAP Radio's own Jennifer Reason played piano for some of the concerts, including tomorrow's finale, which airs at noon on CAP Radio's music station. Jennifer joins us now in studio to talk about the concert series and to play some of her favorites from the past 6 weeks. Jennifer, it's always nice to have you.
So nice to be had. Thank you.
Last time we chatted with you here on Inside, we were setting up the summer concert series. How do you feel now that tomorrow kind of marks a close to this year's?
Gosh, you know, it's bittersweet. It's been an incredible process sharing this music. Every Friday has been something to look forward to. I think it's a real service to the community. It's also a little bit of a chance to breathe. So, you know, a lot of work, but so worth it.
It also just must have felt so good to be a part of these performances as well. I mean, you play the piano.
Yes. And, you know, that was so lacking. I went almost a year without doing what I love most, and that's collaborating with other musicians. So to do that, and with so many amazing artists from this community, it was really just life-giving.
I would imagine you are not alone as an artist with kind of not having that collaboration. When actually playing with fellow musicians, was it kind of emotional or sentimental given the year that we've all been through?
You know, honestly, we all played a couple of notes and then had to stop and take a cry break. So, yes.
Oh. And that's why it's such a great summer concert series. You can feel it.
Amen.
Well, you're playing piano in all but one of the songs that we're about to hear this morning. I guess, what was it like to perform again in this setting, after being away from the stage for so long?
You know, it was odd and wonderful at the same time. It was like this muscle memory thing, but also we hadn't done it. And I think the garden setting was the perfect transition. It was gorgeous outside, all of the plants, and we were able to just kind of make music together in an outdoor safe space. So it was kind of the perfect transition back into live music making.
Well, let's start taking a look back at these just incredible performances. Tell me about I Remember.
Yeah, so this one will actually air on Friday. I Remember is from a Sondheim TV musical. It's a little creepy. It's about people that are stuck in a store, and if they try to go outside, they turn into mannequins. And we picked this because it's I Remember Sky. And it's kind of like the fires and COVID, and we couldn't go outside. We couldn't be together. We were trapped in a sense. So this is a musical testament to what we've been through.
I remember sky. It was blue as ink. Or at least I think. I remember sky.
I mean, you can really just hear the emotion and the longing in her voice.
Amen. Yes, she really captured it.
So the next one is, Will There Really Be a Morning? What is that about?
So this whole concert series really is kind of about the COVID experience, in particular from the perspective of the artists, but from us all as well. And will there really be a morning is kind of that question I think we asked. Will this ever end? Will we ever get to the other side? What will that look like? And we're kind of sitting here in the darkness waiting for the dawn. And I think it's a beautiful musical capturing of that sentiment.
The mountains.
this is why I love music. It just really adds another color and layer to what you're going through in your life as an individual or collectively as a society.
Yes. It speaks to it in a way almost nothing else can.
Yeah. The next song, I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correct. Grieg?
Grieg, yeah. Grieg. Norwegian name there. This one is just piano and violin. So we had a violinist on this concert also, and it's loosely COVID related. They lived in the Bay for a bit, and in their pod was a man from Norway who had just arrived at the United States just in time for lockdown. So this is just a tribute to Norway and to Norwegian and just to beautiful instrumental music.
Oh, I love the pacing of that.
Ah, isn't it exciting?
Yeah, it's so exciting. We have another violin solo, correct? And can you also just tell me a little bit about the violinist?
Yeah, so his name is Justin Ouellet, and he is a professor at the Oakland School of the Arts, as well as a multi-instrumentalist and collaborator, and lots of albums to his name, composer as well. And Longing is a violin solo that he wrote for himself right before lockdown. He had been at a club in Oakland, and there'd been flamenco dancers, and they were going to collaborate. They had to do it over Zoom, as we've been doing everything. So Longing, he wrote as just so much longing to be able to do it together and dance and play music in the same space.
I know this is radio, but I can just visualize the performance and just the amount of technique behind that solo.
Fire. There's so much fire.
Last one is Once I Was. Just briefly set us up, since we only got about a minute and a half left.
Sure. Ricky Ian Gordon wrote this piece. He's a wonderful New York composer. And it's kind of looking at the both sides, right? Once I was, I had this life before COVID in this case. And now here we are. What am I now?
Well, with that is Cap Radio's own Jennifer Reason playing piano in all but one of the songs that we just heard from. And you can catch all of these summer concert series still online, correct?
Yes, capradio.org/music, broadcast and videos.
Well, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez, Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here on Monday.